So you just got back from a week-long delegation in Honduras that took place during the election that happened on Sunday. Can you tell us, kind of set the scene of what happened on Sunday?
Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, in Honduras, they don't even call it an election. They call it the event. They refuse to call it an election. I mean, the vast majority of people, because just calling it an election to them was so offensive. It was described by people as a farce, a pantomime of an election. So I guess to sort of set the context of the event on Sunday, you have to sort of go back to June 28th. And this is something that a lot of the observers, the official observers coming from the United States in particular, refused to do. They refused to sort of try to see this event on Sunday as connected to the coup. To not connect them is absurd to me and to everyone in Honduras, but this is what they've been trying to do. So
June 28th being when Manuel Zelaya was ousted from power.
Exactly. On June 28th, the morning of June 28th, there was supposed to be a non-binding opinion poll in which Hondurans would go to this sort of referendum-style vote where they would determine whether or not they liked the idea of adding a fourth ballot to the November 29th elections, the ones that just took place. The fourth ballot would be a question. Normally there's three. There's an election of a president, an election of a regional governor, and then of a mayor. Mm-hmm. This was an opinion poll to see if people wanted a fourth, and the fourth would have been the question, do you or do you not think it's a good idea for Honduras to strike a constitutional assembly to redraft the constitution? So that vote would have been the morning of June 28th, and of course that was the day that Manuel Zelaya was arrested in his home, flown out into exile in his pajamas. Mm-hmm. And since that time, of course, there's been a de facto regime made up of predominantly, the president is Roberto Micheletti, but it's a de facto regime that primarily represents the oligarchy in Honduras, and the oligarchy in Honduras is really only made up of about 10 to 15 families who own pretty much everything, including all of the media, all of the fast food chains, all of a lot of the agricultural production. Certainly, they're connected to the mining interests and so on. So, to sort of briefly bring us through the 5 months in between June 28th and these elections, this event, essentially, you had the transition, the changeover from a regular state into essentially a police state. Mm-hmm. I met with people, and most of the work that I did while I was there was involved in documenting human rights violations. And there are groups in Honduras, COFADE is one, the Committee for the Family of the Disappeared and Detained in Honduras. And they've been working in Honduras for 27 years, since way back in the 80s, when things were also quite bad. And they've been documenting these cases, an undisclosed number of cases of people since the coup being arrested, detained, beaten, kidnapped, raped. There's been 32 people killed, all under the auspices of the coup and under a police and military state that is targeting people specifically who've been part of the resistance. Mm-hmm.
There was talk also of some radio and news outlets getting shut down. What's happening, or what's been happening in terms of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the many reasons why these elections are an absurdity. The few radio and television and newspaper outlets that were prepared to criticize the coup, and there weren't many, because primarily the media is owned by the same people who orchestrated the coup. But there were a few that were critical. Radio Globo was one, Radio Progreso, Radio Uno, as well as a couple of small newspapers. And they have been systematically harassed and ultimately shut down. There was one TV station, Channel 36, that was harassed. They had their equipment destroyed, chemicals poured all over their stuff. Mm. There were threats to the reporters. The director of the station was directly threatened a number of times, to the point where he actually left the country in exile. One of the critical newspapers, the director's daughter was murdered in Guatemala. She lived in Guatemala with her husband, and she was murdered in what was obviously a political killing based on the way it happened. He also fled the country in exile. So what ended up happening was Channel 36 was shut down, Radio Globo has been shut down, It still functions on the internet, which is very encouraging. But it was one of the few ways people could get information, critical information about the coup and what was happening. And those media outlets have been absolutely repressed as hard as the media could possibly be repressed. You know, one of many reasons why even the notion that there was a democratic process taking place here is patently absurd.
Mm-hmm. And so what has been the reaction of other OAS member governments to this event that happened, or these elections on Sunday?
Yeah, I mean, the response has obviously been deeply frustrating for people in Honduras. There have been a few states in Latin America that have condemned the coup. Everybody has sort of, at some level, said, geez, you know, this coup is not such a great thing. And certainly in Latin America, there are a lot of states that are very concerned, even states that may not be especially progressive. Brazil is a primary example. I mean, Brazil is run by a government that is, you know, sort of to the left, but certainly not not radically left, not the likes of Bolivia or Venezuela or Cuba. But they've been very vocal against the coup because the concern is obviously that if a coup is allowed to happen in Honduras and to be successful, as it has been so far, then obviously this could usher in a whole new sort of generation of coups in Latin America. That used to be the way things went in the 70s and 80s, mm-hmm. you know, through the CIA and the School of the Americas. Coups were a regular thing. They've really become a thing of the past up until 2004 in Haiti, and now this coup here. So there's been some states that have come out against it. Unfortunately, they aren't the ones that pull the majority of the weight. The United States is clearly the most notable, and Canada as well, have both been, you know, mildly critical of the coup, but predominantly supportive of the regime, and in particular supportive of these elections, which, to most people's mind in Honduras, these elections simply whitewash what happened in the coup. They whitewash what's been happening since then, the incredible repression of popular resistance, peaceful popular resistance, I should add. So to say, as the Americans have said and as Canada has said, that these elections represent a step forward or a solution to the quote-unquote political crisis is deeply, deeply disingenuous. The solution to the crisis would be the reinstatement of the democratically elected president, mm-hmm. And to pursue the process that the social movements in Honduras have been asking for, which is a redrafting, a refounding of the constitution, of the laws of the country, of which I could probably say more as well, but there is so much to say. So.
Mm-hmm. There has been talk that what people in the grassroots in Honduras are so upset about is not even actually so much in particular that Zelaya was deposed, but that they were really looking at this potential to rewrite the constitution, not necessarily, I think, in terms of that referendum, but in terms of the Honduras traditionally being ruled by a small oligarchy, as you're saying, and the way the constitution is written now apparently represents their interests, and that people had been really excited about the potential to rewrite the constitution in the interests of the mass amount of people, you know, in Honduras.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the key thing, and in fact, you know, the discourse that's been created in Canada and the United States to a large extent has focused on Manuel Zelaya versus Roberto Micheletti. You know, it's like this political crisis between two big men, of course. Mm-hmm. But that's really not what it's about for the people who've been active in the movements there. The social movements, I mean, an important background on this is that the social movements that have been pushing for Constituyente, which is this constitutional assembly, have been pushing for this for years. This is not something new. And in fact, Zelaya was not especially highly regarded by the social movements in Honduras in the lead-up to the coup. He did a few things that were good. He put a moratorium on Canadian mining concessions, or all foreign mining concessions, which was obviously a step in the right direction. He raised minimum wage slightly, which was a step in the right direction. But in fact, his agreement to even move to a non-binding opinion poll about the Constitution was actually a huge victory for the social movements. They had to really push him to get to that point. Because as you said, I mean, you're absolutely right, the Constitution as it exists right now is totally a document that exists for the purpose of maintaining the status quo, which is obviously a status quo of deep inequality, and also, importantly, the Constitution of 1982 was written in the context of a whole generation of military coups, and it was written in the context of the United States being actively involved in Honduras on the ground with bases, using Honduras as a base for the Contra wars, the wars in Nicaragua, the interventions in Guatemala. This was all happening from Honduras, and that's when the Constitution of 1982 was written. So people are, you know, the real reason that people are in the streets and that people are fighting so hard is because June 28th, the non-binding opinion poll, was an important, a small but important step in a struggle they've been fighting for so long, which is to truly rearrange the social order in Honduras, to truly put some sort of mechanism in place so that the vast majority of people who are the poor, who are the campesinos, the workers, to put money into those people's pockets, to put some kind of structure in place to protect those people. So, in fact, that's really what this is about. And Zelaya and the coup, I mean, it became about democracy and about the fact that their democratically elected leader was deposed. But it only became that on June 28th, I was speaking with a journalist. His name is Felix Molina. He's been a journalist in Honduras for 20 years, and he was telling me that in some ways it's been useful, the coup, because it ripped away the facade of democracy mm-hmm. in Honduras. Because as soon as people started using their democratic rights, you know, the structures that they have in their democracy to actually change things, the oligarchy said, "Okay, that's it. Game's over." And flew the president out of the country in his pajamas. So yeah, you're absolutely right to point to that as the critical thing here.
You mentioned a little while back the few kind of good deeds, you could think of them, that Zelaya had done, including canceling Canadian mining concessions and the raising of the minimum wage. Has that been rolled back since the coup has come into place?
That's a good question. I don't know what's happened to the minimum wage. I would assume that it stayed where it was because Zelaya's change was cosmetic more than meaningful. It was, minimum wage was so low that what he did was he sort of he pegged it to growth of the company. It was sort of complicated. He pegged the new minimum wage would peg to the success of the company so that if the overall output of the company went up, then some degree of the wages would go up. But it wasn't significant. It was more symbolic than anything. It was a sign that, you know, the social movements were actually getting into, you know, his ear to a certain extent. In terms of the mining concessions, I don't know, but I would say there's a very, very good chance that those concessions are being allowed again. In fact, I did have a conversation with someone yesterday on my way to the airport. It's anecdotal. I can't be certain that it, but it's accurate because I haven't followed up on it. But that person told me that, yes, the Canadian and American mining companies are back in like a dirty shirt. And, there's so many small stories of that are just, in terms of the way that North American business ravages countries like Honduras. One of the ones that really stuck out for me was there's fast food chains everywhere in Tegucigalpa. And in particular, there's a great irony. There's a Burger King right outside of the Brazilian embassy where Zelaya is being held. So there's all these protests outside of the embassy, which are also right outside of the Burger King. And I absolutely couldn't believe when I got there and was told many times by people, because it's obviously a major point of contention, that none of the fast food chains in Tegucigalpa pay taxes. So they come in, displace smaller businesses that may or may not have been mildly profitable for some people and helpful for some people, replace those jobs with poorer paying and no benefits fast food type jobs, and then take all of their profits and run with them back to North America and pay nothing back in taxes to the state.
Back to the shareholders.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. And then people wonder why Burger King and Popeye's Chicken and McDonald's is being graffitied and people are throwing rocks at their windows. you know, it shouldn't be a mystery. It seems sort of obvious to me. And this is actually something that, you know, was really eye-opening for me, was how obvious all of these things are when you're down there. You know, up here, we're so removed from what's really going on. There's so many layers of deception, you know, whether it's the statements of our government, whether it's the presentation of this in the mainstream media, there's so many layers of deception and disinformation or disingenuous information. When you get down there, it's all so obvious. Even the notion that this election was well attended, that people came out in strength to support real democracy on Sunday, I mean, it's just absurd. I mean, if you're there, you can see it because you're in the streets, you're walking around to the polling stations. The only people there are the party hacks, like the people that set up their tents for, you know, to hand out paraphernalia from the political party, and the military and the police. Mm.
And now
this
is
in force. I mean, there were more M16s at the polling station in Jutiapa than people.
Hmm. The popular movements now were calling for the boycott of the elections. Is that correct?
That's right.
So people actually chose not to attend. It wasn't that they were prevented somehow.
Right. Oh yeah, no. There was. I mean, if anything prevented them, it would be the fear of going to a polling station and someone holding an M16 over your shoulder. Literally, you know, this isn't an exaggeration for effect. Literally, the polling stations, if you walked into a polling station, there was someone in front and behind you, at least the ones that I went to, with an automatic weapon. That could be pretty intimidating. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, no, I mean, it was the Frente, the popular resistance said, our response to these elections is to reject them. We will not vote. We will show the world that this is a farce by refusing to participate. And, I mean, there was some confusion, and I think, you know, it's important when we try to make sense of this stuff not to oversimplify things. I mean, the Frente is not united. It's not a monolithic bloc. There are lots of people, and many of whom many people I spoke to who didn't agree with the decision to boycott the elections and thought that they should take to the streets, that they should protest, that they should literally stop people from voting. And in fact, there was one group in San Pedro Sula, which is the second largest city. It's very industrial city, there was one group that did go out and take to the streets and demonstrate and protest outside the polling stations. They were repressed brutally. It was tear gas and bullets flying in San Pedro on the 29th. The other groups decided to stick to the original plan, which was to boycott the elections. And it's funny because Micheletti talked beforehand about the elections and said it's going to be a fiesta democratica, you know, a big party of democracy. And in many ways, most of the elections in Honduras are just that. I spoke to people who would, you know, say to me, I was in a town in Danlí, and someone said to me, this street right here that we're on, normally on an election day, this street would be packed with people. It would be noisy, there'd be honking, there'd be flags, blue and red flags, the two major parties would be waving everywhere. You know, this is a party. People go out, they eat food on the streets, you know, and whatever, and they debate their politics. There was nothing. I mean, the streets were empty. Hmm. And so it was really evident to those of us that were there who were going around. And this was the story. I mean, you know, I only went to a few places myself, but obviously I was connected up with other people who were going to other towns and other places. And this was the report that was coming in everywhere, was that the streets were just dead. People had decided, very clearly decided, that they didn't support this election and that they wouldn't vote in it and they wouldn't participate in it.
Did you want to say anything? You mentioned before about mining interests in the area. I understand there's also some Canadian garment industry operating there. Do you want to say anything about the specific companies or things that have happened between communities and those companies that are operating there?
Well, I mean, in truth, I didn't really get a chance to look at that stuff more intensely while I was down there, because the focus right now is so much on the political crisis. I certainly witnessed firsthand the extent to which people are living in desperate inequality. The contrast between the rich and the poor is visible and evident. I mean, it's not something you could miss if you're there. And of course, the other thing that I think is important, at least in terms of the question that you're asking, is the resistance itself has a number of the deck is stacked against them in a number of ways, one of which is that, of course, people have to work to survive. Mm-hmm. So you can't actually, I mean, it's incredible that they were able to sustain the kinds of demonstrations the way they did. I mean, they demonstrated every single day, you know, for almost 5 months. There were demonstrations, sometimes as large as over 100,000. Some have even said up to 200,000 people demonstrating. These are people that have jobs with at factories, garment factories, or you know, working in these fast food chains or whatever it is. And of course, their bosses are golpistas. Their bosses are coup supporters. So a lot of people were threatened with losing their job if they participated in the resistance, and a lot of people did lose their jobs for participating in the resistance. A lot of people were threatened that they would lose their job if they didn't vote. And I haven't heard, because it's only, I guess we're only at Tuesday, so I haven't heard too much yet, or Wednesday, I haven't heard too much about the repercussions yet, but the voting system is one where you dip your finger in ink after you voted, so it's visible if you voted or not. And a lot of people were saying that, you know, if they showed up at work on Monday and their finger wasn't dipped in ink, they would be sacked. Which, you know, among the many things that were really inspiring to me while I was there was that even in light of that, and not just the threat of being fired, but the very serious and real threat of police repression, you know, if you didn't vote, mayors were sent a letter about 3 weeks prior to the election directly from the military, a letter to the mayors of each city saying, we want from you a list of all the names and phone numbers and pictures of the people who are involved in the resistance, the organizers of the resistance. And the mayors were told, we will be coming to get this information from you, the military. So even if you're, you know, a progressive mayor in some community someplace, now you're being threatened by the military that you have to turn over the names of people in the resistance. So, like I said, the level of repression is just so high, and the fact that people continue to resist, you know, I mentioned the thing about the fingers being dipped in ink. We drove through Tegucigalpa on the last day I was there on Monday. There was a caravan of about 1,000 cars winding through the streets of Tegucigalpa, and everywhere we went, people would come out into the streets and wave their uninked fingers, wave their pinky fingers, which has become sort of a really cool sign, like a hand signal of the resistance, is waving that pinky finger to show that you didn't vote. And people were coming, streaming into the streets, showing us their pinky fingers and cheering. So the courage that it's taken for people to do that, for me, was just awe-inspiring. And it was really, an emotional week for me to see that kind of courage, really.
We've only got a few minutes left. If there's anything you'd like to touch on you haven't yet, and if you just quickly, and if you want to also mention, you were blogging the whole time you were down there, so if people want to read more of your experiences in Honduras, how they can get a hold of that information.
Certainly, yeah. In terms of my blog, I was writing every day, and I was posting it to the website of Canadian Dimension. So it's canadiandimension.com/blog, and then it's fairly obvious how to find them from there. In terms of what people can do, which I think is the only other really important thing to get in here, it's incredibly important that we do everything we can to pressure the Canadian government not to recognize these elections. I don't think it's going to work. I'm going to be totally honest. I think that the Canadian government will recognize the elections, and I think Obama will as well. And, you know, and everyone in Honduras expects that too. The resistance there knows that this is a long-term struggle now, that they are, you know, they consider the election day the beginning, not the end. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a long-term struggle. However, that said, I still think it's really important that we do everything we can in this moment, in the short term, to start building the consciousness here in Canada about what's going on in Honduras and how complicit our own government, how deeply complicit our own government is in covering that up. They've already been making statements about how wonderfully free and fair the elections were and how encouraged they are. We have to fight that. So to that end, there is a petition that is going around. It is linked, unfortunately, I haven't memorized the URL, but it is linked from the blog that I've been talking about, and I've been sending it out as widely as I can. I think that if you do a Google search for Honduras, Canada, petition, it will pop up. And obviously, I'll forward that to you, Macho, and you can put that on your website as well. Very important for people to sign on to that petition and to do everything they can to write to you know, the foreign minister, write to the prime minister, write to anyone, write to your own MPs, saying that what's happening in Honduras is an outrage, that the trampling of human rights is absolutely appalling, and to recognize an election in that context is an absurd affront to the notion of democracy. And, you know, if we can at least start building that consciousness here, then perhaps down the line we might in fact be able to start really affecting some meaningful change in a situation that absolutely needs it.
Great. Thanks for your time, Tyler.
Thanks, Macho. I really appreciate being given the chance to tell people what's going on.
Okay. So we'll have that link that he mentioned up on our website within the next few days. And if you missed it, our website again is blackmask.ca. And if you missed it, his blog was at canadiandimension.com/blog, which includes other blogs related to the Canadian Dimension magazine.